Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those words from Gramsci, I welcome you to the Time of Monsters podcast, sponsored by The Nation magazine. Now, I think most people in the world are like horrified and upset at what's happening in the Middle East, both the Hamas massacre of a month ago and the subsequent Israeli counteroffensive, which has led to the deaths of thousands of civilians and is risking a wider regional war. And we're seeing, you know, some of the most upsetting images and events of recent modern history. So, and for, I think, the average person, you know, they might have disagreements as to where they stand on some of the issues, how justified Israel is or is not. But I mean, it's clearly a very upsetting event. But there's a segment of the population that's not so much upset by these events, but is possibly quite excited, because these events, for some people, portend not just, you know, violent death and displacement and suffering, but also possibly the return of the hand of God into this earthly kingdom. They portend Armageddon, which you know, like, to most people is a terrifying prospect. But, you know, like, if you are a particular caste of religious believer, well, that's actually good, because, you know, like, yeah, even though there will be some turmoil with the Antichrist and the final battle between good and evil, at the end, you will get a new heaven and a new earth, and things will all work out. So this week, I want to take up the people who are, you know, are kind of looking at the news right now that we're all looking at and thinking like, oh, this is working out well. This is, things are looking up. I'm talking particularly about the sort of brand of American Protestants that are coming out of the charismatic and Pentecostal tradition, who have a very specific view of the way in which events in the Middle East are evidence of biblical prophecy coming true. And that influences how they vote. And these are not insignificant people. They are, in fact, a major part of the Republican coalition. So my colleague Chris Lehman wrote about them in a recent Nation column, which will be linked to in the show notes. And I wanted to talk to Chris about this, because, you know, like, Republicans are half, you know, of American political system. They control Congress, and there's considerable evidence that either these views or, you know, people who are like neighbors to these views hold, you know, very powerful positions as they exist. And they certainly are people who, you know, have the ear of the likely Republican nominee, presidential nominee, Donald Trump. So Chris, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
So, let's just basically just start by getting a sort of factual description. Who are these people, and what do they believe?
Well, you gave a good sort of thumbnail account of the origins of this strain of prophecy belief, which, you know, go pretty deep in American history, in American Protestant history, I should stipulate. And it's a tradition called premillennial dispensationalism, which is a mouthful. It comes out of a sort of cranky British theologian named J.W. Darby, who put together a kind of telescoped version of how the end times would unfold in the modern era. And it was taken up pretty enthusiastically among prophecy believers in the United States, in part because, you know, America has always been kind of high on its own supply in terms of its role in history, and wants to be in the vanguard of, you know, what Protestants believe is the ultimate redemption of fallen earthly history. And that does involve the literal onset of the final battle at Armageddon, and then the, you know, parousia, the kind of second coming and judgment, final judgment. And so throughout American history, what's kind of interesting is a couple of things. One is the original Pentecostalists were kind of an outcast movement within modern Protestantism. They were a lot of poor dirt farmers in Oklahoma and Texas, and later African-American believers in a critical revival in Los Angeles. But, and this is a story of denominationalism in the United States writ large, they become very influential and rich, basically. And so you have this weird, you know, the prosperity gospel, for instance, comes out of the Pentecostal tradition. Joel Osteen, who's the most, you know, famous prosperity preacher out there, was schooled in what's known as the seed faith branch of Pentecostalism, which holds, you know, you pray, basically, the crude scheme is you pray for riches and God showers them down on you, and that's how you know you're saved. So this exists alongside this kind of end times, everything's going to, you know, fall apart and God's going to come and, you know, as you say, grant a new heaven and new earth. And what's critical for these believers is the state of Israel. The, you know, founding of modern Israel in 1948 touched off a sort of boomlet in prophecy speculation because, you know, it's kind of foretold, you know, first that the Jews will come back to ancient Judea and then convert to Christianity as the final sign of the end times. And so that's one important thing to mark in the prophecy tradition embrace of Jews, which, you know, Netanyahu, the prime minister, has aggressively embraced John Hagee and these other sort of militant Zionist Protestants in America, because he believes, you know, he's making the crude and I think accurate political calculation that they advance his interests.
Yeah, and he's doing it at a point in which more traditional groups that had supported right. Israel are souring on them. I mean, one sees it, you know, like in the Jewish community, like especially among younger Jews, there's a sort of real dissatisfaction. And a lot of the, you know, mass protests that we're seeing against Gaza right now in New York and elsewhere have been led by, you know, young American Jews, but also beyond them, the sort of broader liberal community, which had been like, you know, like more Zionist than conservatives in the right. 50s, 60s, and 70s, you know, as the nature of the Israeli occupation has come to light, has sort of soured on that. So if you're, I mean, the political calculation is, you know, like, well, we're losing these right. groups, we have to find another support. And yeah, and if it's people who think that, you know, like, you know, our state exists so that there'll be a World War III will happen and all the Jews will become Christian. Well, you know, yeah, I think Irving Kristol, the neoconservative, put it very cynically but accurately when he said, well, they have their theology and we have our state. I think their theology won't come true, but we'll still have the state.
Yeah, no. And I think that's exactly, you know, Netanyahu's bet. It's the same bet he's made in aligning with militant religious fanatics in Israel.
You know, yes,
this is kind of the only constituency he has left to court. But yeah, it's important to note that, you know, Hagee also has a long history of personal anti-Semitic statements. Mm-hmm. And this kind of embrace of Israel is not cognate with any sort of appreciation for Jews remaining Jews. They're supposed to convert. And and, you know, basically hand over the state in the service of the end times theology.
So, yeah, no. I mean, yeah, Hagee in particular, like, seems like really. I mean, he basically said Hitler, as you quote in your article, is right. was a half mongrel Jew, you know, and had very other disturbing things. But more broadly, yeah, this evangelical tradition, I mean, like, you know, it doesn't like Jews like in the diaspora, right? Like they have as a bad role. They're not being participating in the narrative of the final apocalypse. They're spoiling things, right? And then and more broadly, I mean, I do think there's a connection between, you know, Netanyahu's willingness to court, you know, this group of people who are, you know, anti-Semitic but Zionist, with his alliances that he's formed with people like Viktor Orban or the, you know, Law and Freedom Party in Poland, you know, of groups that are, you know, have at least some anti-Semitism in a European context, but are okay with Israel because, you know, like, well, that's a place where Jews can end up, right? Like you want, yeah. So I mean, again, it's a very cynical logic there, but there is a logic.
Yeah, you know, under present conditions, you can see how it plays out, and it is playing with fire. I mean, yeah. One of the first things that Hagee did after the October 7th attacks was he, you know, gave this fiery sermon from his home congregation, basically calling for war with Iran right away. Mm. And it's important to note that Israeli diplomats were there in attendance, and prominent congressional conservatives like Ted Cruz and Tom Cotton videotaped statements, you know, just not necessarily calling for instant war with Iran, but, you know, definite, you know, statements of affinity with Hagee and the larger project. So, yeah, this is dangerous stuff, especially as you noted, you know, this constituency of, well, two things. One, as you noted, they are a very significant element of Trump's base, and Trump is increasingly coming to recognize that explicitly. He talks about evangelicals much more out on the stump. And second, you know, this Pentecostal strain of prophecy belief for a long time has been sort of mutating and taking over American evangelicalism writ large. So it's no longer this kind of crank, you know, series of manic charts and arrows that it began with. It's stuff like the, you know, vastly popular End Times of Fiction, Hay and Jerry Jenkins' The Left Behind books. It's the late, great Planet Earth, which was the best-selling nonfiction book of the 1970s. You know, this is, you know, beyond sort of traditional denominational and theological categories. This is like a category of wish fulfillment thinking on the Christian right that is, I think, on the vanguard of how they think about world affairs. And it's really worrying.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And I think the distinction that you made, like between the sort of, you know, broader evangelical world and Pentecostals, I mean, that was it's a line that's blurring. And I think it's worth just saying a little bit about the history of that. Because I mean, traditionally, and I think this is true until the 70s and 80s, you know, people that, you know, we might think of as, you know, like very conservative or right-wing evangelicals like Jerry Falwell, they were actually, you know, in the 70s, like a little bit wary of the Pentecostals, like on theological grounds, that the Pentecostals had all these things like, you know, speaking in tongues and believing in like actual prophecy, like individual preachers being able to like foresee a faith healing, you know, like these are things that like within the Protestant tradition, you're a bit wary of. I mean, particularly like, you know, like in a lot of ways, the original Protestants were, you know, like trying to demystify religion, to actually turn it into like theology and get rid of the what they saw as the magic components of Catholicism. But all those magic components have returned, like with a vengeance, the return of the repressed. And so in the 70s, they were kind of wary of it, but like out of political alliance, but even more broadly, out of the sort of shift and changes of their own congregation in a mediaized culture, you know, they were finding that their own people were like starting to listen to these things, and you got a blurring of the line between evangelicals, so that, you know, like sort of belief in things like spiritual warfare, you know, prophecy, faith healing has become a much more mainstream thing. And this is accelerated. I mean, one sees this already in the 70s and the 80s, where people like Pat Robertson, you know, were increasingly working with people like Jimmy Swaggart, but it really accelerated in the Trump era. This is something, I'll link to it, but Sarah Posner has written a lot about, and she did a podcast with me, and she really, one of the points she emphasizes is that this sort of charismatic Pentecostal Christianity has become much more mainstream under the Trump era. And one sees it in all these concerns of like sort of spiritual warfare, conspiratorialism, you know, like literally seeing Hillary Clinton as a demon, a demonic force. Yeah.
A while ago, I interviewed the great religious historian Anthea Butler, who basically said, evangelicalism isn't evangelical anymore. It is Pentecostal. There is this, you know, rampant popular embrace of the idea of demons and the idea of spiritual warfare, as you're saying. This what's known now as the Seven Mountains movement, which comes out of the New Apostolic Reformation, which is a Pentecostal development. It's interesting in one sense because it's post-millennial. It's not in the same vein of prophecy belief, but it's because they have so firmly embraced worldly power for its own sake, that they just want to keep the franchise going. They don't want to blow it all up at the end. And it is, you know, it's kind of a gloves off version of the old religious right model where, again, because of the, you know, what was seen as the imminence of the final judgment, you know, Falwell and Robertson and others basically preached, you have to provisionally seize control of, you know, the political sphere, the media sphere, the sphere of culture at in sort of a caretaker fashion. Mm-hmm. But the New Apostolic Reformation doesn't truck with any of that. You know, it is all about, you know, the seven mountains are things like the media, the family, the academic culture, the whole sweep of, you know, the institutional life has to come under dominionist Christian control. And it is also explicitly anti-democratic. You know, mm-hmm. it's operating on a model of biblical kingship, ultimately. Mm-hmm. So this Lance Wallnau, who's like, you know, wrote a influential Protestant pro-Trump tract back in 2016, calling Donald Trump, you know, Christianity's chaos candidate. This is, you know, the sort of best known New Apostolic Reformation figure out there. He's incredibly influential. There are these, you know, the Moms for Liberty has a very legible alliance with the New Apostolic Reformation movement. And you'll see at these gatherings, you know, these businessmen kind of taking up the sword of faith and, you know, basically professing that they're going to take control over everything and they're serious. So, yeah, and it did, you know, all get supercharged by Trump's 2016 candidacy and the continuing influence of Trump and the Trump, the MAGA movement. Paula White, who is, you know, loosely understood as Trump's personal pastor, who allegedly sort of stage managed, you know, something like a conversion on Trump's behalf, is a Pentecostal prosperity preacher. So,
although I have to say, I mean, I've seen the photos where Trump is sort of like bowing down in prayer with these Pentecostals, and I don't think he looks particularly at ease or comfortable. Who am I to question another man's faith? But
you know, the Lord works in mysterious ways.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, back speaking of the 70s, Pentecostals were the most active in recruiting the American business community into. You know, what were basically the 20th century version of the old businessman's revival of the late 19th century. Mm-hmm. So there is this, you know, longstanding alliance and, you know, the prosperity tradition is the legacy of it. But,
yeah.
You know,
that's I mean, this is a very worldly form of Christianity because, yeah, it is like, you know, God wants us to get rich and he wants America to be powerful and to like, you know, smote the enemies of the United States.
It's also importantly like very counter-institutional in the ways of, I mean, they want to control institutions, but they don't want to sort of observe traditional modes of pluralistic deference within them, right?
Yeah. And also, I mean,
you had mentioned earlier, you know, the kind of drift away from theology in the American tradition, and the Pentecostal movement is very much the vanguard faith in that direction. It's all about what, you know, what has been called primitive Christianity, direct experiential worship, stuff like you were saying, speaking in tongues or snake handling, as those are illustrations of the forms of worship described in the Book of Acts. And, you know, the idea is that modern day Pentecostals, getting rid of all the institutional accretions of corrupt, you know, Catholic and Protestant faith, and going back to these kind of direct channels with, you know, prophecy and spiritual experience. And that's a very powerful tradition. And the drift away from theology is really important because there's no longer an effort to reconcile these kind of practices with, you know, traditional forms of discourse or, you know, traditional kinds of churchly observance. It is all kind of out on the frontier of, you know, direct experience.
Yeah. Yeah, so I mean, in some ways, I mean, I think that's a really great point. Like, so much of this religion, like, it seems to be like exactly the American religion. Like, it's very much in keeping with the American society, you know, like that has come out of, you know, after World War II. Like, you know, with the sort of, you know, triumph of media and television, with the sort of individualistic capitalism, and with America as a global power, right? And there's ways in which, yeah. I mean, you know, I think there's a tendency among some people on the left, or perhaps even the former left, as our late colleague Christopher Hitchens, to like sort of see all these extreme religions as like antithetical to modernity, antithetical to, you know, what we rational people believe. But it's all a product. I mean, the apocalypticism like flourished because of the Cold War. Like, if you have American presidents saying that, you know, we're in the final battle between, you know, like godly America and godless communism, that's going to stir up like people suddenly listening to Pentecostals. That will encourage people to say like, oh, you know, absolutely, like the president is saying.
Yeah. Now, if you go back to the Billy Graham's landmark revival preaching again in Southern California in the, I think, late 40s, if I got the date right, but it was right after China tested the nuclear bomb. And so it is all about, you know, the end is nigh, and, you know, it's going to happen because, you know, of nuclear proliferation. It's all very explicit and upfront. And yeah, that is, you know, it's, it does so happen I read an entire book about all this.
Yeah, I know for a fact you've read many books about all this because you're very well versed in the history of American religion, which is and so there's, you know, the apocalypticism of the Cold War fed into this, but also the sort of individualism and celebration of worldly success that is very mainstream in American culture. Yeah, the celebration of celebrity and media culture. So you have these celebrity preachers, the distrust of intellectual life and the anti-intellectualism of American life. That's not just true of Pentecostals. And in some ways, they're doing the same thing that everyone else is doing. I always think about the fact that, oh, who was the guy, Jimmy, was it Baker who had the sex scandal to Tammy Faye? And
well, actually, Swigert had one. I think the Bakers were just traditional, though I think he did have an affair.
He slept with the church secretary, which is a very traditional American thing to do. But I always remember that he became like a preacher and ordained when he was like 11, right? And you could do that because, like, if faith is all that matters, and at that point, I think he's admitted in an autobiography, he actually didn't read the Bible and hadn't ever read the full Bible until after he went to prison. Well, he read the Bible in prison as an adult, but he was like an ordained minister, and this is very much part. But that is also coming out of sort of American democracy. Like, who needs all this book learning? You know, who needs Augustine? Who needs Calvin? Right? Like, who needs?
I mentioned Joel Osteen earlier, and his degree is in communications from Oral Roberts University, fittingly enough. And he has absolutely no theological background, and so you know, when you go to, as I have, I've attended Joel Osteen revivals, and he is talking about old fashioned faith healing, and, you know, the proof of divine favor is always, you know, he also says things like, you know, God intercedes in his life to give him a good parking space.
Well, there you go. I mean, that's a very, very practical God.
And allowed him to flip a house before the 2000 meltdown. So, like, it is, but of course, the big problem with this brand of prosperity preaching, which, you know, is not being put to test the same way now in the Middle East conflict, but you have the problem of, if God is favoring you with wealth, he must be punishing the poor. So it's a very retrograde and reactionary, you know, way to sanctify the inequality of capitalism.
Absolutely. Although, I mean, I think there are like interesting sort of parallels, like with the Middle East. If God does have certain people, you know, in plan as the sort of, you know, chosen victors of history, which they actually see as Christians, right? Like, the Jews are the kind of, you know, handmaidens, or, you know, like,
it's a purely instrumental role that they're
but that also means that, like, the actual people living there, you know, like the, you know, the Palestinians, or, you know, like the broader Arabs and Persians who will have to die in these wars, well, you know, like, they're not part of God's plans, right? They're part of God's plans as the defeated, as
collateral damage. They're yeah. to be thought of in prophetic terms, really, at all. Again, what's so dangerous of having a character like Hagee being so influential in the modern conservative movement? I mean, John McCain was forced to disown Hagee after getting his endorsement in 2008 because of the anti-Semitic things Hagee has said in the past. But there's not, you know, now Hagee is in the mainstream.
Yeah, he's in the mainstream. And you mentioned, like, he was involved with the ceremony when they moved the American embassy, which itself, I mean, okay, there's
a big concession to the evangelicals was the embassy in Jerusalem. Yeah.
Yeah, which itself is like, you know, like it has real world geopolitical consequences because, like, you know, the Jerusalem, control of Jerusalem, you know, like this multi-faith city is a big part of like what's the point of contention. But to have, like, you know, this diplomatic move, which was made by Trump, but then, you know, like basically agreed to by the Biden administration, the big pushers were the evangelicals, and one of the participant of the ceremony was, you know, this lunatic, anti-Semitic lunatic.
He proclaimed at the occasion that Jerusalem is the eternal capital of the Jews, which is, you know, just a very charged assertion. Again, not made for the sake of the Jews. That is
no, absolutely not. No. But Netanyahu, for his own reason, is very happy to have that. It's a very troubling thing. I want to, though, like rounding out the conversation, like maybe make a point about the broader relationship of all a faith of many different branches of faith in this conflict, because I do think, like, you know, like especially we once saw it during the war on terror era, there was a kind of, you know, centrist, liberal, sometimes formerly left, as I mentioned, Christopher Hitchens' view, which just sees religion as the problem. Religion, you know, like as Hitchens says, you know, poisons everything. And that at the time, I always found that like a very stark and Manichaean view, because like, you know, religion is a very complex thing that has existed like for, you know, throughout human history and takes many forms. And within like the sort of Middle East, I mean, like, you know, there's very, we all recognize there's very many different types of Judaism, there are many different types of Islam, and there's also many different types of Christianity. There's an older sort of, you know, liberal Protestant and also Catholic tradition of engaging with that region with a view towards promoting peace. A lot of, you know, liberal Protestants are involved with refugee relief. The Pope himself has been calling for a ceasefire. But also, and I think this is very important, they're, you know, like Christians in the region, like throughout the Middle East and in Israel. And these are, you know, people who have been, you know, among the Palestinians, but also other communities that have been Christians there for long periods of time. And what I think is interesting is the way in which this kind of, you know, Pentecostal view, it has the effect of totally marginalizing or even like eclipsing or making invisible these Christians, you know, because like they are also victims of this. You know, there's a church in Gaza.
Right. And it's absolutely true. It's kind of, you know, weirdly, they're kind of in the same position that a lot of secular minded Israelis are vis-a-vis Netanyahu's you know, alliance with religious fanatics in Israel. They're like, you know, what the hell are you doing? Like, and you're also jeopardizing our lives and home. You know, it is a very direct kind of threat to, you know, what, as you've noted, is, you know, in some cases, you know, centuries long Christian presence in the region. So that's the other, you know, those people too are just kind of instrumentalized and shoved to the side. It's not, you know, if they're not going to get on board with, you know, basically, you know, throwing over their homeland to the project of bringing, you know, the second coming to pass, the John Hagees of the world have no use for them.
No, that's exactly right. And so, I mean, maybe tying it in with what you said earlier, which I thought was a great point, you know, this is like, you know, Americanizing the faith. So Christianity is American Christianity. So the fact that there are these, you know, historical Christianities that like long predate the United States,
it's a big inconvenience to the American prophecy faith. And again, I write about this in my book a lot. It's hilarious, actually. If I don't recommend this to our listeners, but if like me, you have read all 12 volumes of the Left Behind series. The main action usually is, it makes no sense in terms of either actual scriptural prophecy or, you know, the weird military engagement that's happening under the what's called the Tribulation Force, who is this band of people who weren't swept up in the rapture, but yet somehow have to battle the Antichrist. Anyway, the main action across these 12 novels is always, you know, they have to like jet into the Middle East to like, you know, kill a bunch of dudes, but then they always have to go back to the United States. And then it makes zero sense. Like your logistic base of operation is 4,000 miles away from the main action. Like, what are these guys doing? But of course, it has to be that way because Americans have to be leading the vanguard and making the second coming happen. It is really demented. If you just think about it in Kitchener terms of like, okay, if you're plotting out a war for to redeem the Middle East, like, why are you based in Chicago?
Well, yeah, yeah. No, I mean, but it is, I mean, yeah, part of this American creed that, I mean, Jesus was an American who spoke English, you know, with a good like, good Midwestern accent, you know, blonde, blue-eyed Jesus.
I mean, that's why I, you know, it's a case of both more that both Pentecostalism and Mormonism are the signature American. They're the face that basically won the Second Great Awakening and come out as like the American faith. And Mormonism, of course, contrives to create a whole alternate scripture and a version of events in which, you know, this, you know, sort of vagabond tribe of Israel migrates to the United States and the Garden of Eden is in Missouri. Like it is all like it is really a kind of genius on Joseph Smith's part to sort of intuit that this is what American believers really want. And
Yeah. No, I mean, maybe just to sort of end this, I mean, it is interesting. I mean, there are alternative Christianities and, you know, one of the great American lyrics, you know, in the beauty of the Battle Hymn of the Republic says, right. You know, in the beauty of the lilies, Christ was born across the sea. But, you know, like, I think this form of religion asks, well, what if he wasn't? What if he wasn't born across the sea? Exactly. What if the beauty of the lilies is right here in America, that this is God's promised land and that it will have the right to remake the world in its image, including the Holy Land, right?
Like very much including the Holy Land,
Yeah. Right. So I mean, which is why, you know, it all ties together. The project of trying to dominate the American political system is particularly doing God's will. And then it also, you can, you know, take those beautiful lilies and then turn them into a nice American garden.
There you go. Exactly.
Okay, good. So anyways, Chris, thank you. This has been a very enlightening, although also terrifying conversation.
That's my franchise. Yep. Thank you, Jade. It's always, as I said, always a pleasure.